From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, an incredible story of a UFO abduction case. Here's what's happening. The FBI is probing a possible cyber breach of numerous company email accounts belonging to the New York Times reporters by apparent Russian government-linked hackers. The investigation, which is ongoing, is looking into how and how far the perpetrators infiltrated the Times email accounts in question. It was not exactly known how many New York Times email accounts may have been compromised. What are the hackers looking for? The central Italian town of Amatrice was badly damaged by a 6.2 magnitude earthquake that struck early on Wednesday. People trapped under the rubble. The death toll will go up. A 21-year-old woman died after she lost her footing on a notorious cliff in Southern California, plunged 100 feet onto the rocks below. What was she doing? She was taking pictures. Please be careful when you're doing that. New U.S. single home family sales unexpectedly rose in July, reaching their highest level in nearly 9 years as demand increased, brightening the housing market outlook. I just hope there's not another bubble. A tiny fleet of tiny satellites that could one day be used to detonate plasma bombs in Earth's atmosphere to improve the range of radio communications. The U.S. Air Force has granted contracts to three research teams to develop the technology needed to do this, with hopes that the CubeSats, as they call them, would carry massive amounts of ionized gas to the ionosphere to create radio-reflecting plasma. How about that? And NASA has announced it has reestablished contact with Stereo B after communications were lost back several years ago. Contact with spacecraft, which works in tandem with a second spacecraft, Stereo A, to study the sun, was lost during a test of one of its timers. Now let's check in with Dr. Sky Stephen Cates for his weekly report on just what's going on up there. Stephen, what do you have for us?
Well, hi, George. Always exciting things here. The European Southern Observatory is on the verge of making an announcement here, and I hope it comes very quickly, of a small Earth-like planet of all objects that's discovered around. Get a look at this. It is the nearest star to the Earth. We call the system the Alpha Centauri system. Astronomers call this little red dwarf star around Alpha Centauri, Proxima Centauri. And what makes this so exciting is that the distance of this star is only 4.24 light years away. Now imagine, of the 4,000 planetary objects, Earth-like planets or objects that are out there that the Kepler Observatory has identified, only, George, 216 of these are Earth-like. So this itself, when announced officially, and it's coming, they say, within 24 hours, the details to come.
I love it. Great story.
This is quite fascinating indeed, and it's something even more fascinating. Texas Congressman John Culberson wants to see an Alpha Centauri probe launched at least by the year 2069, as we hopefully figure out the physics of how to make something go near the speed of light. So is billionaire Yuri Milner trying to do the same thing with a one-gram-sized spacecraft, hopefully moving physics off the chart and trying to get a 20% of the speed of light craft to move through space. So we could make contact in our lifetime. But in the live sky, George, always important information. If the listeners watch any clear evening, hopefully the next evening they look into the south, that great conjunction of Mars, Saturn, and Antares, the star, the supergiant in Scorpius, has changed from a beautiful triangle now almost to a straight line. But the best, folks, is yet to come. George, as we've been talking about, on Saturday evening, August the 27th, a super conjunction of Venus and Jupiter. This is something, folks, you look into the twilight sky just after sunset, get those binoculars and telescopes ready. Jupiter and Venus come within, as I mentioned before, biblical proportions of close, as far as a conjunction, 1/30th the diameter of a full moon. So if you have a telescope, you'll be able to see both of those objects in the same field of view. Very, very rare. And, George, we always say it, always remember to keep your eyes to the sky.
Well, once to run out and make you get a telescope right away, Dr. Sky. Up next, Dying to Wake Up, a doctor's voyage into the afterlife and the wisdom he brought back. That's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Dr. Rajiv Pardee is a world-renowned cardiac anesthesiologist and was the chief of anesthesiology at Bakersfield's Heart Hospital for more than a decade before having his own life-changing near-death experience. Now he tours the country holding workshops, demonstrating methods of healing to help others overcome addiction, depression, and chronic pain. He wrote the book, Dying to Wake Up. Dr. Rajiv Pardee with us on Coast to Coast. Doctor, welcome to the program.
Yeah, I'm very excited to be here.
It's good to have you here, too. And what a varied career you have. Now, a cardiac anesthesiologist does what? You're there during cardiac surgeries?
Yeah, mainly, he specializes in anesthesia for heart surgeries. You know, and then, of course, it can be split further into adult heart surgeries or pediatric heart surgeries. And I specialized in adult heart surgeries.
You see it all, don't you?
Oh, yeah. You know, it is a literally different feeling when you hold, you know, somebody's heart in your hand. You know, I normally, anesthesiologists don't do that, but one day I asked the surgeon, I want to hold the heart in my hand. So I scrubbed and held the heart.
That is amazing what technology does now. Now, what happened to you? You had a near-death experience. Tell us about that.
Yeah. You know, like my life was going on pretty good till August of 2008. You know, I was chief of anesthesia, living the American dream, actually extreme American dream, you know, fancy cars, big house, big vacations. And then I got diagnosed with prostate cancer.
Prostate cancer, oh my God.
And one of the options was to remove the prostate totally. It is known as radical prostatectomy. And I didn't want to get it done locally in Bakersfield or, you know, LA because they were opening the belly, but I found out another urologist in Miami, Florida, who did it laparoscopically, you know, with small holes in the belly.
Right, which is much better than a major incision.
Exactly. And you know that I've given anesthesia for those surgeries too, and they take 5-6 hours, you know, to take the total prostate out. So I flew to Florida, had the surgery, everything went fine, the cancer was gone, but it left me with complications, especially left me with incontinence. I had to wear diapers. And where the anastomosis, the main tube known as urethra, was cut and joined again, I was getting repeat scarring. And that had to be lanced by laser or by a cold knife. I needed about 7 surgeries.
Oh, God. Jeez.
Yeah. And that led to pelvic pain. And that pelvic pain led to depression, you know, and also other questions. Why me? I was mad at God. You know, what did I do? You know.
And how old were you, doctor, when this was happening to you?
Yeah, I was, I think, 53.
Yeah, that's a young age.
Yeah, nowadays it is very young. I feel very young.
Yeah. So then what happened?
And then for pelvic pain, they prescribed me chronic pain medications, you know, opioids, which I used to prescribe to my patients because I also had a huge pain management practice. And you may be surprised to know that nowadays prescription drug addiction is a bigger problem than illegal drugs.
Oh, yeah. We've talked about it on the show, doctor. It's horrible. It's out of control.
Totally out of control. And I became a victim myself. And then 2 years passed by, and I'm still not getting any control over my bladder. So I see a professor at UCLA, University of California, Los Angeles.
Now, are you able to go back into anesthesiology at any point while you were healing?
Yeah, I was working.
Okay.
Yeah, I was working, you know. I was wearing diapers, and sometimes I requested my colleagues to cover for me, you know. So I was still chief of anesthesia at Heart Hospital, and, you know, I was technically very good at, and I loved my job. It was really very fulfilling, you know, to see somebody not make it during surgery, you know, stop and go, the heart wouldn't start, And then you see him sitting up next morning having breakfast with his
yeah,
family.
Yeah, it's a miracle.
It's a miracle. Honestly, you don't care whether he had insurance or didn't have insurance, but made one feel good. You know, I did my job.
So while this was going on, I suspect you got addicted to pain pills.
Exactly. And depression.
And depression. I mean, everything that was going wrong was going wrong for you.
Yeah.
Then what happened?
And, you know, then also during this time, my relationship with my eldest son deteriorated because I had kind of forced him to go to medical school. He dropped out. I was mad at him. You know, my father started showing through me, you know, nature-wise. But coming back to the medical issue, so I saw a professor at UCLA, urology professor, and he recommended that I get another surgery, which is to implant an artificial urethral sphincter, so I have control over my bladder. So that surgery was done in the around, I think, 13th of December of 2010.
Another surgery.
Yeah. And, you know, surgery went fine, but 2-3 days later, I started having high fevers.
Oh, God.
Redness.
Infection?
Yep.
So I'm not a doctor, and I diagnosed you.
Yeah.
So with the infection, which is very dangerous,
yeah,
in the hospital you go.
Yeah. First, they tried oral antibiotics, and then they tried very heavy-duty IV antibiotics, especially, you know, any medical personnel listening, gentamicin and vancomycin. And it was not improving. And, you know, once the infection goes to the blood, then it becomes sepsis, and one can go into septic shock. And even with modern technology, septic shock has a 70% mortality. So before that happened, they decided to do an emergency surgery to take the device out because it had become the source of infection.
Ah. All right. But it may be too late. So they in they go, right?
Exactly. And I looked at the operative report, and, you know, the exact surgeon's words were, there was an explosion of pus.
Oh, gosh.
You know, explosion.
Now, I've always been told, not to get too graphic here, but pus is a good thing because that's an accumulation of all the dead cells.
Yeah, exactly.
But you still want to get that out of your system.
Yeah, totally. You know, so clean. You know, we literally take a lot of water, distilled water, to wash the inside out.
Mm-hmm.
Totally clean it. And during that emergency surgery, I had my near-death experience.
Okay, so what happened? How did you literally die with that kind of surgery?
So what happened was, like, anesthesia was induced, and about 20 minutes later, because I had seen the clock while going in the operating room, I found myself floating near the ceiling and could see myself being cut open. And my first reaction was, you know, maybe somebody used the wrong medication, you know, like I'm hallucinating or something, because there is a drug known as ketamine. It's like a PCP, which gives the out-of-body dissociative anesthesia, but it was not used. I checked the record later, and it is very, very rarely used in adults, human adults, but is used in veterinary medicine and in little children for especially burn dressing changes.
Ah, okay.
You know, like, because that's pretty painful, and they have to have dressing change every other day. So that's where we use it. And I could smell the fluid coming out, and the nurse was applying the eucalyptus oil to the mask of the surgeon and the anesthesiologist. And the most amazing thing was, the anesthesiologist told a joke, which I remember after surgery, but I can't repeat it and remember it because it was a dirty joke.
Yeah, we don't want to do that.
Yeah, I know, it's a family show.
But so you're out of your body, and you're hearing all this. They're talking about you, they're laughing, they're joking, and you're in serious condition.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Did you come back and tell them, hey, you said this?
Yeah, I did talk to the anesthesiologist, yeah.
And he probably was in shock, right?
Yeah, it was. He was in shock, like what had happened to me when another patient of mine told me when he had the surgery, a different heart surgery of his experience.
How long, doctor, do you think this episode lasted?
The total time from my consciousness and the time I woke up in, I woke up with a jolt in recovery room, and I think it was about an hour and a half or two.
Oh, that's a long time.
But I want to clarify that I was not dead for all that hour
right,
and a half.
Right, you weren't brain dead. Nothing stopped functioning for an hour and a half. But it did happen for what, a few minutes?
You know, like the surgery and everything, hour and a half, yeah.
So during this episode of this out-of-body experience, what led you to believe that you had probably seen the other side? And there's some other areas we'll get into after a commercial break where you can talk to us about how you almost felt that you were on the brink of hell and a place you really don't want to go. But what made you think that you had died? When you came back and you were alert, or were you realizing this when you were in that state?
When I was outside my body, that's when I realized something is not right. And I went through different realms, and when I came back to my body, you know, like my life totally changed. That's where the book title goes, why the person who went to sleep and the person who woke up were two different people.
Two different people, yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, dying to wake up is, you know, like metaphorically for everybody, you know, like in Indian culture, you know, when a person becomes a holy man or spiritual, they literally light their own funeral pyre, like symbolically that they are taking a new birth.
We are with Dr. Rajiv Partee, and we're talking about his near-death experience, which he cataloged in his book, Dying to Wake Up. And when you were in this dying state, did you feel that state of bliss that people feel, like they don't want to come back?
You know, I did not feel that bliss in the beginning part, but the beginning part was pretty horrible. I was in pain.
Mm-hmm.
But when I was in the presence of the light being, it was very blissful and very, to me, it was very peaceful, you know, like I talk about the Sanskrit word shanti. It was like cosmic peace.
And I would guess that you're probably Hindu, right?
Yeah, I was born and raised in India.
And the people who practice the Hindu faith are very spiritual. They believe in the afterlife. They believe in reincarnation.
That's true.
So this was an experience, but something that wasn't non-believable to you. And by that I mean, because of your background as a Hindu, you did believe in the afterlife, right?
Yeah, but I was not a practicing Hindu, you know, like, I did do my rituals, you know, like when the festivals came, we did everything, you know, friends and family. We even used to celebrate Christmas because we live in America. But I was not, the religion and spirituality did not factor in my life. It did factor in my life when I was 18, when I wanted
right.
to become a monk. But otherwise, in my day-to-day life, when this episode happened, it didn't factor in my life.
And how are you feeling now, physically?
And right now I'm feeling pretty good.
Good. And you have everything licked?
Yeah, and then after this near-death experience, about 8-9 months later, I went back, I had another surgery. And then the doctor implanted the same device. Previously it was on the right side, then he implanted in the left side, and everything works.
Well, that's good. Now, stay with us, Doctor. We're going to come back in just a moment, and we're going to talk about exactly what you saw on the other side. And some of it is pretty frightening. We'll be back. And if you don't get your ticket soon for our Asheville, North Carolina event, you will be up there on the roof. I kid you not. All the seats are sold in the bottom level. Everything's up there now for you in the balcony. So when you go to our website, coasttocoastam.com, and you click the Asheville, North Carolina event, which, by the way, is this Saturday, you will click tickets and you'll get into the website of the theater. But when the picture shows up for you to select your seats, you have to click the balcony, so make sure you do that. Or if you, by mistake, click the bottom level, there's a little corner section there that you can click, and it'll take you up to the balcony. But that's where you pick your seats. And come on out. We're going to take walk-ins. They've got some tickets for walk-ins. And the rest of you, just come on out. We'll have a great time at our event in Asheville, North Carolina, this Saturday. And welcome back to Coast, George Dory with you with our special guest, the Dr. Raviv Party, his book, Dying to Wake Up. He's a doctor who died and came back to talk about it. Doctor, I'm wondering if some people think that near-death experiences are merely a quirk in the brain, that when you're at this point of death or lack of oxygen or whatever happens, people have these similar thoughts and think that they've died and gone to the other side. Is that a possibility?
You know, scientifically speaking, you know, I used to believe the same thing too before, you know, because I had given anesthesia to a patient who had surgery on his aorta, the main vessel coming out of the heart. And normally while doing a heart surgery, we put the patient on bypass pump, so the blood keeps going through the brain, oxygenated blood. But in that case, we had frozen the patient because for some part of the surgery, we could not keep the blood going through his brain. And I thought he had brain damage. That's why he was telling me out-of-body experience. And I thought he's having psychosis. So I gave him an antipsychotic Haldol shot, you know.
Okay, so when this all occurred, it wasn't all rosy. It wasn't all great. Tell us about some of the horrible things that happened to you during this experience.
You know, the most horrible thing was when I found myself where I could, being forced towards the area which, you know, like dark but thunderstorm, fire raging, and I could hear, you know, a lot of wailing and crying. And I can see people, you know, like dark entities. And I was being pushed by force, and I didn't want to be there. And my first reaction was, why am I here? You know, and as you talk about the Hindu religion about me, you know, like, what have I done in my life, you know? Mm-hmm. You always talk about karma. And I asked for help, and I was given the realization that so far I had led a very mean life. You know, I was after money to get rich at any cost and step on toes. You know, like I was good doctor technically, but I did not connect to my patients, you know, like empathy or, you know, heart to heart.
Really? I would have thought you did, but you realize your shortcomings.
Yeah. Like giving an example, there was one patient who was 70 years old with arthritis, and she came to me for pain medication, and I gave her the prescription, and she wanted to talk to me about her husband dying and what problems she was having in her life. But I didn't have time, so I wanted to go and see the next patient or do more procedures. So that's because financially I was going bigger and bigger houses, and my mm-hmm. mortgage actually at last time was my previous house was $15,000 a month.
Jeez.
And you know, like it was a huge 11,000 square foot house and a golf course and a lake. And actually, because a stage came where I would kid with my friends, do I own the house or the house owns me?
Well, that's true. That is true. At what point, though, something changed and you were greeted by what you believe were angels?
You know, that came after the review. So while I was in this hellish realm, who came to help me was my father.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And who had died about 30 years ago following a heart surgery in Fresno, California. And I was shocked. Till the last day of, you know, even though I was 53, you know, I was that time when he died, you know, 30 years ago, so much younger. But though I was a doctor in America, I was still scared of him.
Sure.
Because he was, you know, physically kind of, abusive, and that was, he was a product of partition of India, you know, Indian Pakistan. There was genocide between Hindus and Muslims. My family's from the Pakistan side, so he came to India hiding among dead bodies. So he had a traumatic stress disorder, I would say, now. And he took it out on me. What he could not become in his life, he forced me to become.
So go ahead.
He came to my rescue, and he actually gave me the feeling, and I felt that he really loved me. But he could not express it. And that has repaired my relationship, not only with him, but it repaired the relationship with my own elder son. To show people that you, when you love them, that you really love them, not assume things. And so he led me from there towards a tunnel. And in the tunnel, I had present life review, and for me, the most amazing thing was two past life reviews.
Two. That's pretty dramatic all by themselves.
Yep. And one of the past lives was that I was a cruel prince in medieval times, and I was whipping, along with my soldiers, poor farmers. I can see them in tattered clothes. And I don't remember the reason. But the amazing thing was that I asked forgiveness from them. And I used to have pain in my right wrist. And I had three surgeries. I had torn a ligament, you know, triangular fibrocartilage in the wrist. And at times I was not able to work. One time, almost 6 months, I could not work because anesthesia is a very hands-on technical specialty. I was maybe thinking I should become a psychiatrist that time because then I don't have to use my hands. But the amazing thing is, after I asked for forgiveness, though it was in the past, my pain disappeared.
Just like that?
Yep. And I was able to work full time. And I was discussing this with Dr. Raymond Moody. And mm-hmm. How can you go back and ask for forgiveness? You know, time is always linear, you know, progressing forward. And then we were talking that actually in the other realm, time is not exactly the way we see it. And I've later read about some other NDEs experiences too, that it can go backwards, or past, present, and future are existing at the same time.
When all this was happening to you, as you look back at it today, would you consider yourself fortunate and lucky?
Yeah. Very fortunate and lucky. Yeah. Actually, I described in my book, I made two personalities of me, Lucky Rajiv and Poor Rajiv. You know, like I want to be Lucky Rajiv today or I want to be Poor Rajiv today. You know, like, so, you know, I want to be the same circumstances I see that one can make it. I can be a lucky Rajiv that I got to follow my dharma, change my profession, and be in spirituality. But now I drive a Toyota Camry instead of the Hummer I used to have, or a sports BMW. You know.
Well, Sam Walton, who owned the Walmart stores, used to drive an old beat-up pickup truck, Doctor.
That's so true. And, you know, like my life literally and figuratively went from Hummer to hybrid.
Now let's talk about these angelic situations.
Yeah, so after this past life experiences, you know, one was a poppy farmer. I was on the other side of the tunnel, and I was greeted by two beings, you know, angelic beings who communicated to me that they were Michael and Raphael, my guardian angels. And when I told my wife about it, she was shocked, and she asked a very valid question. What happened to the thousands of Indian god and goddesses? Where did they go? Why didn't any of them show up? And I, to be honest, I didn't have any answer. I said, I'm telling you what happened. You know, so why didn't they show up?
It is interesting that a practicing Hindu would have angels show up, but you know what? Spirituality is spirituality, isn't it?
That's exactly, George, what I believe. You know, all these beings are there to help us. That's how I'll later on describe to you the seven eternal truths. So these angels made sense to me later when I read, especially Raphael, is the angel for healing, for healers. And he helps in healing and is a patron saint for doctors. But you know what my favorite angel nowadays?
What's that?
Gabriel.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And
you still get visitations, don't you?
Yeah, and with Gabriel, I really spend it, or her, you know, people call it her or he. They don't have any gender asset, but I like it as he, as her. And I'm on your show. That's Gabriel's grace. I'm flying to New York tomorrow because for people from Tia Fox and family sent me an email through my webpage. They want to invite me on Friday. And all these things are happening which were beyond my dream or I never expected. And I have a lot of thanks and gratitude to Divine. Especially, and if you want to objectify it, for me, it's Gabriel.
How has this event changed your life?
Oh, my life is totally different in almost every aspect. What I drive, what I eat, where I live, my relationship with God, with my wife, with my kids, everything is different. For example, you know, God, I watched that movie Secret.
Yes.
And I made a big vision board, car vision board, a house in Malibu on the beach, you know, a Ferrari and all those things, because that's what I learned from there. Imagine every day driving a Ferrari and one day it will show up. And I literally floated that board. It was made of cardboard and paper in the ocean once I was going to Santa Barbara. And with the prayer, you know, like kind of serenity prayer, that I really don't know what is good for me. God, Divine, make me happy in what you give me.
Has your family seen a difference in you?
Especially my eldest son. You know, as I said, you know, my, you know, the physical abuse and verbal abuse. I was not physically abusive to my son, but verbally I was, and...
Well, that's because it happened to you as a child, too.
Yeah.
That happens.
Yeah, and that was broken. He dropped from medical school after spending 6-7 years. Now he's doing computers, and he's very happy, and I'm very happy. My daughter was, you know, I'm a Hindu, was dating, and still has a Muslim boyfriend. I was very mad, but I accepted, and he's a very nice person. So, you know, these all changes happened after my near-death experience. And that's why I say three things, you know, practice of prayer, meditation, and service, which I call seva, are the key to a fulfilling life.
What did you learn? What lessons did you learn when you came back? Not lessons that, you know, have changed your life, of course, but what have you learned about the universe, about why we're here? What did you learn?
Yeah, you know, these are actually very good questions. And what I have learned is nowadays is the evolution of consciousness going from lower planes to higher planes is what is taking place. And we all have a kind of soul contract we were born with, or purpose, and we need to fulfill that purpose. But that purpose can change at a different stage in life. Like one time for me, for 30 years, was the anesthesiologist to be the best doctor I could. And now is help people through spirituality connect with their inner core. So the evolution of consciousness and to serve other people is what is very important.
Doctor, are you totally convinced that the other side is real, that it exists?
From my experience and how things changed for me, I'm very convinced.
You had a shared death experience with somebody. What happened?
You know, like kind of a portal was opened for me after the near-death experience.
Yes.
I started having spiritual experiences often in dreams, or, you know, like I talk about experience I had meditating in Dharamshala in a Buddhist retreat where Dalai Lama lives. And the shared-death experience happened when my very good friend was dying from metastasis of colon cancer.
Oh, gosh.
To his liver.
Once it hits the liver, it's pretty bad.
It's very bad. You know, he tried, a radio frequency and everything. And, you know, that feels tragic that he was, you know, having bleeding in his rectal, and he thought it was hemorrhoids, didn't go to the doctor, you know, all those things. You know, so we all should do our duty, get regular checkups, you know. And so when he was dying, yeah, I saw him at the night before, you know, he was almost semi-comatose, you know, because you're...
Of course, yeah.
You know, when the liver is filling, you know, all the ammonia and, you know, all the toxins build up, because liver is the biggest detoxifier. And early morning, I felt a light in my room. You know, and the room dimensions changed. A kind of portal opened up, and he was there standing and waving at me and calling me. And, you know, he was my best friend, Naresh. And so I went with him, and I left my body, and I saw a being, and I did not really recognize. I prostrated like a Hindu, you know, we touch the feet and we do namaste.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and that being telepathically told that, it was like, I think about 7 foot Middle Eastern with the beard, that he was Jesus, and it was my duty to fulfill, practice, not Christianity, but Christ consciousness, which I call Krishna consciousness, to live from a higher plane. And then my friend and being separated from me, and I kind of it. They went to the other side, and I came back to my body.
Amazing how that works. We're going to come back in a moment talking about coming back out of your body with our special friend, Dr. Rajiv Pardee. His book is called Dying to Wake Up. We're going to take your phone calls. If you have experienced near-death experiences or you just have a question, check in with us. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM to take your calls on that, on a subject that is always fascinating and very near and dear to my heart as well. We will be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.